supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it's a question asked hundreds of times at the beginning of every season. I want to start composting now, and I have no dry, brown, shredded fall leaves from last year to make compost with. You're always warning us not to just use green waste. What can we use instead of fall leaves to get some compost cooking? It's a great question. I've got some great answers, and you'll hear them when we get to the question of the week. Mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. At 1-888-346-9499. Chuck, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Chuck. Where are you, man?
I live in Western Washington State, on what we call the wet side of the mountains.
Oh, okay.
And, I've loved every minute of it, right up to the point where I started getting into organic gardening. And according to one expert, our incessant rains have, over the eons, leached all of the minerals and valuable nutrients from the soil, except for potassium, which apparently the evergreens, our trees and our underbrush, everything that makes it look so lush around here, they just love potassium. But as far as an organic gardener and what he needs for the soil, apparently it's practically barren. You emphasize in your book of compost how important it is to have dry, dead leaves for your compost. And in the first place, we have not that many deciduous trees around here, and I'm wondering, due to the poor quality of the soil, if that would affect the leaves' value as compost.
So are you in the Seattle, Bellingham, Washington area, somewhere around there?
Pretty much, yeah. We're down towards the southern end of Puget Sound. We're not too far from Olympia, a little town called Steilacoom, halfway between Tacoma and Olympia.
I've been there. I took a trip to Alaska, and Bellingham was the jumping-off point for the Alaska Marine Highway. And I've visited Seattle separately. And I love your climate. The trick to being a Seattle gardener is a lot like in the southern Alaska area, southwest Alaska, is
right.
That the weather is much milder than people think. Your winters tend to be fairly gentle, and your summers don't get brutally hot, but there just is not often enough sunlight or temperature in the outside world to grow the most popular fruiting crops that people remember from the East Coast, tomatoes, peppers,
sure.
Cucumbers. So What I saw most is people's outdoor gardens were coal crops and root crops and leafy crops like salad greens, a lot of potatoes. All the serious gardeners I saw in the Seattle area had some form of a hobby greenhouse that they would use to concentrate the sunlight and the heat. And that was what it took to get good crops of tomatoes and peppers, not soil nutrients so much, although you are in a bad place, like some other parts of the country in terms of deciduous leaves. Everybody's soil is poor, Chuck. I mean, you have your reason for thinking your soil is poor. My soil is poor because it's full of clay, which scientifically retains nutrients, but in physical reality is like trying to grow vegetables in bricks. People in other areas who have sandy soil can't hold any nutrients in their soil.
Right.
There's like three guys in America, Chuck, who have good soil. So you, especially, need raised beds. How much room do you have?
Yeah, we've got about 3/4 acre. It's heavily forested right now, so light is a problem, but we're having a few trees taken down.
You know, when I say greenhouse, I'm saying greenhouse with quotation marks around it. There are very inexpensive structures called high tunnels that you can walk in that surround your crops where you are with the constant moisture. This can be a godsend to preventing disease. with clear plastic. They can concentrate the heat. You have sides that can roll up if it gets to be a really hot, sunny day. Typically, you have a door at either end that can be propped open. If you want to be really fancy, there can be a fan in there to vent it. But typically, opening up the ends and rolling up the skirts is all that's necessary. You would have a tremendously long growing season. I would want you to build raised beds inside. And then you just need to find one big source of compost once and have it delivered to your place to fill the raised beds, 50-50 compost and topsoil mix. And then it sounds like you're going to be trying to make compost from various ingredients.
Right. Yeah, we've got a couple barrels going, thanks to your book on compost.
You read about all the alternatives to leaves if you're in a leaf-free area and you're using all the browned-out stuff from last year and everything
like
that.
Yeah, that's pretty much gone. So I was wondering, too, we have like a vacant lot nearby with tons of these broad-leaved weeds of some variety, and I was wondering, would it be better than nothing to add like green leaves from those weeds to the compost so we don't just have kitchen wastes moldering out there? Or
very important. I think weeds that have not gone to seed with a lot of soil still attached to their roots function much differently in a compost pile than kitchen garbage. Most any plant, when it turns brown, has lost its nitrogen and is now, you know, a carbon-based form. Composting is an art. You learn it as you go along. But I think if you clear some land, get some sun, install a hobby greenhouse, or I like these high tunnels. Look them up online. I mean, you'll be able to grow all of the crops of summer with just that little bit of help. I visit farmers who have these high tunnels and hoop houses, and they are so far along, it makes me ill. So find a good source of high-quality compost. Fill your raised beds with it. Then, you know, maybe use some organic fertilizers throughout the year. But in your climate, even with that added heat, your plants will need less nutrition than a plant down in Texas or Southern California or something like that. I think once you concentrate that heat, once you make that little bit of an artificial environment, you'll be off to the races and showing off your tomatoes.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Mike. That's a huge help.
Good luck, man.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Julie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Julie. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I am doing just wonderful. Where is Julie great?
I live in Northport, Michigan.
Oh, okay, so that's why you're great, right?
Oh, exactly.
All right, what can we do you for?
We have a pasture that has been, I guess, neglected for about 20 years, and so it's fairly overgrown with autumn olive.
Oh.
And we would like to graze our sheep out there, and the advice we've been given is how to get rid of this autumn olive includes herbicides, and I guess we'd like to do
so I guess you've been told to cut the trees to the ground and then paint herbicides over the roots, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Yeah. With many of these so-called invasive shrubs, goats are one of the answers. There are professional weed-eating goats that go into fragile ecosystems. We had a guy on the show years ago who actually had a herd of like hundreds of goats that they were using in California to get rid of something. And he said it was amazing. Once they turned the goats out into this wild area, they almost completely ate the invasives and left the native plants that they were hoping would somehow come back alone. And, of course, they did what goats do in the woods and fertilized the plants left behind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could cut them down physically, you know, drag away the top part of the plant. And I wonder if your sheepies would eat any regrowth and perhaps keep them under control by themselves.
Yeah, that's kind of what we were thinking. They will eat the tender shoots. They couldn't kill a full-grown shrub like goats could.
How many sheep you got?
3 adults and 3 lambs. So.
Okay. And you got a big pasture.
It's a couple acres, yeah.
I would think that, first of all, you have a big job ahead of you. How many trees, shrubs, need to be severed no matter how we're doing the rest of this?
It's pretty thick.
And are we going to go in sections, or are we going to destroy ourselves by exhausting all of our resources the first month?
I suppose if we're smart, we'll probably do this over two or three or four seasons.
I like it. Okay. And you'll clear certain areas. If you see that the sheep are not eating the regrowth, there is a tool called the weed wrench that was designed for easy removal of the roots of invasive plants, so you wouldn't have to get a backhoe. Is there a man involved in this work?
Oh, yeah.
Well, then he'd like to get a backhoe, wouldn't he?
He might, yeah.
And pull these things out, because, you know, that's what they'll do in the real world, is they'll just backhoe the whole thing up and do that sections at a time. But were it me, I would chainsaw them down about a foot off the ground in a test area, keep the sheep fenced in there, see how they do with it, and it may just be progressing to different areas, which you're going to want to rotate your pasture anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be your use for the land will also be a solution for the problem.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, good luck, and remember, if it took 20 years for it to get this bad, it is smart to take a couple of years to remediate it.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, Julie?
All right, thank you.
Good luck.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everyone who listens to our show on broadcast radio that the station bringing you this fine program needs your financial support, because you're the public in public radio. But don't go making that call or visiting the membership section of your station's website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what you can use instead of the fall leaves you should have saved to start composting now. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com. And Star Roses and Plants, the company that introduced the knockout family of roses. Drift roses are low-maintenance, disease-resistant, and hardy to zone 4, a cross between full-size ground cover roses and miniature roses that bloom all season. More at starrosesandplants.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, can you start composting in the spring? If you can, what can you use instead of shredded fall leaves to get your compost cooking if you didn't save those precious fall leaves? We'll tell you the best replacements for leaves as the dry, brown, essential component in a compost pile when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, though, lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Mark, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, great. Thank you for taking my call. I've got some blue spruce pines that are in the house that we currently live in. They're in the yard, and they've started to thin at the lower levels of the pine, but there's also a white blotch at the bottom, and I'm just wondering if I've got some type of predator on the tree.
Actually, no, I don't think so. Now, are we talking one tree or more than one?
We've got a line of about six of them, little different sizes, but pretty much uniform.
Right. You know, that's a treacherous thing to do, Mark. Whenever you plant six trees in a row, the fourth one always dies. All of these evergreens have a tendency to brown out at the bottom and have some branch loss at the bottom if they don't receive full sun on all sides. These beautiful spruces that we see in the occasional front yard that have that skirt that covers their feet that goes all the way to the ground and is perfect, they're getting sun on all sides. They're not getting any kind of shade. So my first question about the browning at the bottom, which is very normal, is are they getting sun on all sides, or is this a result perhaps of not enough full sun?
I would say that they certainly do not get full sun on all sides. We have a giant oak tree that towers above them, and I would say they probably only get a half day of full sun, maybe three quarters.
They will not perish from this. They will not be sickened by this, but they will never be as full, especially at the bottom, as a tree that gets full sun. How long have they been in the ground, Mark?
We bought the house from some neighbors, and I would think that they've had them planted about 8 to 10 years.
Oh, so, Mark, and none of this is your fault.
That's the best answer I want to hear.
You're totally clean,
man.
All right. Now, is there any mulch underneath them?
No, I don't know at one point in time if there was mulch, but they're not mulched right now.
Do you feed them anything?
No.
And this kind of white you're describing, have you only noticed it as they're beginning to grow this spring?
I've been in the house a year, but that spot has been there as long as I've been in the house.
Is the spot on the trunk or on the branches?
On the trunk, near the ground.
Okay. I think it's just lack of airflow, man.
Okay.
Are there weeds growing up around them and stuff?
There's a grass line that's pretty close.
It would be good to hoe that grass out of there. So there's at least, I was about to say a foot, but I'd prefer to see a foot away from the outstretched branch of the tree, which may not be possible. But don't let anything grow underneath them. And the browned out branches on the bottom, it's like half brown. There's some green needles on the end, but the insides are brown.
I would say actually that the browned out needles are about 2 feet off the ground. The branches don't start right at the bottom, but it's somewhere between the 2 foot mark and the 4 foot mark is about where I'm seeing the browned out branches. And yes, there still are other live branches near them, but it's just thinning and some are dying.
Well, the branches dying low to the ground without full sun is very natural. Nothing's wrong there. I think the white stuff on the trunk is either just a little bit of spruce schmutz. You know, sometimes these, like peaches, they'll bleed a little bit of sap, and that will turn bright white. I would go out there, I would get a good pair of pruners, and I would take off all of the dead branches. And then maybe take off one or two of the living branches to kind of even things up and get some airflow in there. I would just take a rag and a bucket of water, and I would just go out and kind of scrub away at that white stuff, maybe with a scrub brush, and literally physically remove it. Because the big question is, are the tops of the trees lush and greenish blue, and do the tops look healthy?
They do. They do.
Yeah.
And it backs against a fence, so I don't know if that has any other bearing into it, but it backs against a pressure-treated fence. Again, all this was there when we got there, but I don't know if that would have any impact either.
The chemicals that leach into the ground from that fence aren't necessarily good for the tree, but I think the enemy here is they're clearly crowded. Obviously, remove any completely browned branches. Remove some stuff low to the ground, even if it's green, to even everything up. Scrub that white stuff off. Move the lawn back a little bit. Just think about giving them some air down there, because they're not going to get sun. Nothing's going to change that. So if you can't give a plant enough sun, you give it everything else you can, which in this case is going to be airflow. And if you want to be the world's greatest caretaker, after you move that lawn back a little bit, put a one-inch mulch of compost down on the surface of the soil around the trees, starting 6 inches from the trees and going out as far until you get to the lawn.
Thank you, Mike.
All right. Well, thank you, Mark, and good luck with your spruces. I think everything's going to be fine.
Great. Thank you.
Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Jay, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, good morning, Mike. This is Jay. I'm calling from good old Winco, PA.
Very good.
I've been gardening and composting my whole life, really, thanks to my dad. And my sister is also an avid gardener. She lives in Virginia, down by Madison, Virginia.
Right.
She told me not to put banana peels in the compost. And
because?
My answer, why, she didn't remember. And so I looked on the website, and I looked under kitchen waste, and I didn't see anything about banana peels. What can you tell me?
I can tell you that banana peels have a long gardening lore and are objects of almost veneration. There are people who religiously bury banana peels around their plants with the theory that bananas themselves are loaded with potassium.
Right.
Potassium, of course, is one of the three essential plant nutrients, and they figure this is a good way to get potassium to their plants. I've heard it especially for roses, for some reason, where people attribute all sorts of mystical powers to it. The only problem with banana peels and citrus rinds and other things of that nature, which if you've been composting for a long time, you've probably noticed, is that they don't compost at the same rate as apple cores or lettuce leaves, and that when you sort through your finished compost, you have some still fairly structural intact banana peels behind.
Right?
Because they are so fibrous. So they are as good as any other kitchen waste. They may be better. This may be one of those things where I need to look it up to be sure, because I know I used to think that string bean plants would be loaded with nitrogen because the plants can take... Well, it turns out most of the nitrogen goes into the string beans and we eat it. So I don't know how much potassium is in the peel and how much is in the banana fruit itself. But I would imagine that, you know, the banana peels are average to better in terms of kitchen waste. The problem, of course, is getting them to compost. And the answer to that is if you wish to incorporate them, they just have to be chopped up. You can't throw them in whole. I know there's people who experiment. They buy an old garage sale blender, and they try to liquefy these kind of things, and then they pour it into their compost pile. I have been told not to overdo citrus in the compost pile, because citrus does contain a lot of naturally occurring, very powerful chemicals, you know. There's the orange sprays and Orange Guard, which is a highly effective insecticide against fire ants. And all it is essence of orange peels. And believe it or not, one of the best materials for taking graffiti off of buildings is just made from orange peels. So they can be, corrosive may not be the right word, but they can be there. And they're better trapping slugs in the garden. But I would think if you can chop your banana peels up into small chunks or liquefy them, that they would be a mitzvah in the compost pile.
Then we'll just try that, because I haven't put a banana peel in my compost since. And
This might be one of those whisper down the lane things where she got it backwards, because so many other gardeners will tell you banana peels are like miracle cures for plant problems.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, Jay.
Thanks, Mike.
Keep eating your bananas, man.
Okay. Thanks.
1-888-346-9499. Lee, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks. I'm calling from Princeton, New Jersey, and have a question about how to place my tomatoes. I have a small yard, and I have raised beds, and I've got lots of vertical gardening going on that prohibit me from rotating my placement of tomatoes every year. They would throw too much shade on the rest of the garden, and I've got to put them in the same place. And I guess I've read about different problems that can come from having tomatoes in the same place year after year. And I was wondering if there's any advice you could give me about how to mitigate the fact that I can't rotate my tomato crops around.
And not only shade, but I'm guessing some of your vertical gardening is kind of a perennial trellis that you have up in certain areas.
No, it's all vegetables. I mean, I rotate through my beans and cucumbers.
But can't you put a tomato where a cucumber went?
They're so close together that they're really in, like, adjacent spots. I've only got 16 linear feet, and the vast majority of it is tomato, so that doesn't allow a lot of rotation.
No, 16 feet, and I'm sure you got too many plants crowded in there.
Yeah.
Now, you say you're in Princeton. I know Princeton and Lawrenceville and that area very well. Aren't there a ton of community gardens near you where you could plant your tomatoes with abandon and maybe spread out the stuff in your backyard?
I guess so. None are within walking distance, so the idea of driving to a community garden seems a little
to me. It would be if we were talking about string beans or peas or something that when it's coming in needs to be picked every day. But tomatoes, there's a lot of wiggle room. You could you could visit the tomatoes on weekends and holidays, in a custody battle, and they would probably do fine. So I would want to consider that. I would consider, do you have any areas of your house you could install some pretty big planters that would gain you some extra space?
That would be tough, but I mean, I guess that's possible, but there's not, I mean, rotation of tomatoes is that important that I should consider community gardening as an option.
How long have you been growing tomatoes in the same spot?
This will be the fourth year.
And you haven't seen the yellowing or the browning of the lower leaves?
I have.
Oh, okay. Yes, that's going to get worse, unfortunately. That's the sign that you have. In Princeton, I would say it's exclusively verticillium wilt. Now, fusarium wilt is more of a problem in warmer climates. But they both do the same thing. They both simply build up in the soil where tomatoes have been grown year after year. And every year the symptoms get worse until finally this little annoyance of the lower leaves turning yellow turns into plants that die by July or August, and it's heartbreaking. What kind of tomatoes do you grow? Do you have your tomatoes for this year? Do you start them yourself? Are you going to go out and buy them?
I've started some myself, some Early Girls and some Brandy Boy and some Sun Gold cherry tomatoes.
And when you chose those, you didn't look to see which ones were resistant to this wilt?
No, I pick them. I mean, I try to, when there's an option that I like that has a variety, I would pick it. I didn't double check for this in particular.
Okay. What you want is tomatoes that on the plant tag or on the seed packet have the letters V and F.
Right.
That's verticillium and fusarium. There's other letters out there, but they don't apply to your situation. You, for instance, don't have nematodes, and I presume you're not a smoker, so you don't have to worry about tobacco mosaic virus. If you are a smoker, don't handle your plants until you wash them afterwards. Wash your hands after smoking. But those are the disease-resistant tomatoes that are bred that way. You're going to do better with VF plants. You have two options. One thing you might want to try this year is see if there's a lot of hip nurseries in your area. See if anybody is selling grafted tomatoes. I've been seeing these spring up all over the place this year. These are tomato varieties that are grafted onto the roots of a different variety, and the root system is probably the most known resistant to these soil-borne wilts. Hmm. So if you plant them correctly, make sure that graft is never buried, the roots will be the only thing that enters the soil, and that's a disease-resistant tomato. And then tomatoes can be grafted very easily, so there's no limit to the varieties that they could put upon these roots. So you can grow any variety you want, but the rootstock has been engineered to try to help you out in your situation. And this is why they are grafted specifically for people like you and all of us, 90% of us who don't have the room we would want. Your other option is to really swap out a massive amount of soil in the hole when you plant your tomatoes. Really try to get a lot of the old soil out of there and replace it with a mixture of ProMix, you know, one of the seed starting loose potting soil mixes in compost, say 50-50, and that would protect the roots from most of the disease. They would eventually get into soil that was contaminated, but they would have a good early childhood education. If you don't want to join a community garden, you don't want to grow in containers, you want to stay in your backyard, those are your two big choices, is grafted tomatoes, which I'm led to believe are vastly superior to just regular old disease-resistant varieties, and really excavating some soil and kind of creating a new planting area by default in the same old area. You know, you're keeping the frame, but you're swapping out the pictures.
Well, great. Those are some wonderful options.
Well, we wish you luck. We're all about tomatoes, and we always want to see everyone succeed.
Thank you.
All right. You take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everyone who listens to our show on broadcast radio that the station bringing you this fine program needs your financial support because you're the public in public radio. But don't go making that call or visiting the membership section of your station's website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what you can use instead of the fall leaves you should have saved to start composting now. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com. And Star Roses and Plants, the company that introduced the Knockout family of roses. Drift roses are low-maintenance, disease-resistant, and hardy to zone 4, a cross between full-size ground cover roses and miniature roses that bloom all season. More at starrosesandplants.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll tell you what you can use instead of shredded fall leaves to get some compost cooking this spring. But you're going to have to wait through a couple more of your fascinating phone calls first. At 1-888-346-9499. Dana, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you.
Well, thank you, Dana. Where are you?
I'm calling from North Philadelphia, so I'm in a very urban area, and I have a vacant lot that the city gave to us, and we've been trying to garden it for maybe the past 5 years.
Really? So you set up garden plots in it?
Yeah, it's pretty rough. It's we have a few garden plots, a few planters with flowers, and we had an area for the kids to play as well last year. We took the slides and stuff out, though. So, yeah.
Did you have the soil tested before you started planting things?
Oh, no. It's very rough. I mean, we've added compost to the growing areas every year.
I have to chastise you a little bit.
Oh, no.
Urban land is frequently highly contaminated with lead. Mm. And especially since you mentioned children, the danger is not so much in eating produce grown in the contaminated soil, but the lead is easily inhalable and you absorb it through your skin. But you should send a sample. You said you're in Philadelphia, so the sample would go to Penn State, or they would tell you who does the least expensive lead test in your area. Because you're in the inner city, you may even get a break. They may do it for you for free. But I would urge you to have it tested because it's, you know, I'm not going to tell you to have all the soil hauled away or anything like that. But
I was going to say, then what if it is high? What would you suggest to do?
Then you would need a physical barrier on top of the soil where the children are playing. Like in this case, this would be a good use for hardwood mulch or chipped bark or wood chips or something like that.
Well, we did have some wood chips in the area where the kids are playing.
And you would, you would need a solid barrier.
Yeah.
Because it's the lead dust that is dangerous. And you would have to warn the gardeners that they cannot work in the soil with bare hands under any circumstances. And unless you're going to remediate the areas, they should probably wear dust masks. Now, what's the problem you're trying to overcome?
Well, the problem I'm trying to overcome is stray cats pooping everywhere. I want to try to figure out a way that I can repel them, keep them out. I mean, a fence would be too expensive to build a fortress around it. You know, every day I go in there and I have to clean up something, and I know I'm missing some of it. I'm worried, too, about the possibility of it being dangerous for vegetables being grown, you know.
This is very common. 90% of people misunderstand these dangers. Mm-hmm. The danger is immediate. It's not being transferred to the vegetables. The danger, you know, obviously everybody knows that pregnant women shouldn't go near this material.
Right, yeah.
But there is a danger to the children of being in an area where especially urban cats have done their business, and there's a physical danger to people like you if you're not wearing very heavy gloves when you touch the material. And again, being careful not to inhale anything. Now, you have a garden in North Philly, and it's not fenced, and it hasn't been destroyed?
Oh, it has a fence. It has a fence, but they're not cat-proof fences. You know, it's a chain-link fence.
Good, good.
And they, you know, they climb it or they squeeze in between, you know, the place between the gate and the fence. So,
in an urban area like this where there's lots of cats, I would get the most inexpensive chicken wire I could and reinforce all the lower areas. And then at the top of the fence you have a very simple baffle of something like chicken wire just coming out a foot laterally that would prevent them from climbing up. You can go to our website, go to You Bet Your Garden, click on Garden Answers A to Z, and go to the critter-proof fence. That'll explain the baffle, a loosely supported foot that comes out at the top of a fence like this. I think you can run a line along the ground so they can't crawl under the fence. You can make an interesting patchwork job that will ride along with one or both of the poles so that when the fence is closed, they can't squeeze through. And then I think the baffle at the top will be very helpful. This fencing solution, reinforcing the fence and putting the baffle in, will be once and done, very cost effective. But then, you know, vigilance, you're going to have to watch. They're going to want to get in there. They do not have a lot of loose soil. So even though it may sound dumb, if you have a vacant area or a vacant lot right near your garden, to clear up a patch of soil there, give them something else, and maybe they won't have the desire to try to fight their way through your fencing.
Yeah, that's a good idea. There is a lot right next to it where I could probably open up a little area for them.
I think that'll make the task 100 times easier.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Good luck. 1-888-346-9499. Jeff, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you, Mike. I call because I think you have a certain kind of love for a squirrel.
Oh, yeah, yeah. A certain kind of love is exactly the right way to put it. Where are you, Jeff?
Well, we're now in Florida, but we mainly stay in New York State. But I used to feel probably the same love you have for squirrels as I did.
Right.
And then one day I had these problems with the squirrels. So I took a piece of plastic pipe and I put a piece of wire around it and I plugged that sucker in. And I learned that the squirrels, when they climb up the pipe, they get a shock and they jump off. Well, all of a sudden I noticed that the squirrels would tell one another somehow. And nobody would climb up that pipe. So I figured this is a good thing, except that I'm afraid my grandchildren would grab a hold of this sucker and die. So I figured maybe I should change it around. So we put on the horse pastures, you know, the solar deal and a battery. And
okay,
shock, and that worked.
So you set up an electric fence of sorts with a solar charger.
Exactly, and we put two copper pipes around the plastic, and then we found that squirrel would jump over to the top of a tree on top of the feeder house.
So, Jeff, wait a minute now. So we got how many pieces of copper pipe and how much flashing? Are you building an amusement park for these squirrels?
Well, it's actually got just a 3-foot piece of plastic pipe and a piece of wire that wraps around it, and it's an inch and a half. And this whole thing sits on top of it, and two little 1-6-inch pieces of... But what happened was we put fruit trees out. So then we put the fruit... So we wrapped the same concept around these small dwarf fruit trees we have, and we put a thing over so the birds don't get it, and we found that it does the exact same thing and keeps the deer away. So this whole... we wrapped the thing like a insulated and wire gizmo, and we've actually keep the deer away and the squirrels away on a small 2-by-2-inch mesh, and it keeps the birds off the little dwarf trees, and they don't touch our fruit trees anymore. So it's almost like that water thing that you buy, and it sprays trees when the squirrels walk by.
I use a motion-activated sprinkler. You appear to be setting up an electric chair for the National Wildlife Federation.
The reason why I do that is I don't have water in a lot of these places because it's so far away. But the electric fence, automatic charges, works great, and it works for probably 8 trees in the pasture there. It works great, but I just wanted to... touch bases with you on that.
Okay, now wait a minute. I have 2 questions. I'm going to ask the obvious one first. At your best estimation, how many times have you shocked yourself since the beginning of this mad experiment?
It only happened once.
No.
Only once. I won't go into the details of what it was.
Thank you.
But I did. I actually got a really... But now I know that when I walk over, I'm going to go near those, near those trees. We definitely turn the switch off on the charger.
And do you have the fruit trees inside an electrified fence like Jurassic Park?
Well, we have the fruit trees. It's an enclosed area for solar panels, so the horses don't run against them. We put some dwarf trees outside in the solar portion, so it always gets some sun. Because, of course, that's the brightest part of the area. And then we have raised bed gardens there, so we can do gardening.
No. What's the electricity going through?
Oh, we just took plain 2-by-2-inch fence, and it's insulated between, one goes to the ground, then there's a piece of plastic. It goes on plastic rods. Then the fencing's around the rods, and there's an insulated portion again. Then the fencing goes around the rods again. So anytime a squirrel tries to go up and they touch 2 different parts of the fence, they get a shock. But when the deer went to go near it, it knocked the heck out of the deer too, so they keep away from it.
Well,
so we don't have to spray the tree anymore.
Well, Jeff, you get the Elmer Fudd Award. I mean, you're living the Warner Brothers cartoon life. I am, to use a phrase, in shock and awe. So, thanks for sharing. Good luck. Don't touch the fence, and don't be surprised when the squirrels start building little wooden ladders to go over it, okay?
Hey, thank you very much. Have a good one.
You too, Jeff. Take care.
Bye now.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. How to make compost without fall leaves. Bonnie in Centerville, Delaware, writes, you often mention that one of the secrets to making successful compost is to include sufficient brown material in the mix, specifically shredded fall leaves. But in the fall, I mow all my leaves and use the shredded leaves as mulch for my shrub and flower borders. As a result, I have little left over to use in my compost pile. I'm hoping you have some suggestions for other sources of brown material. Well, thank you, Bonnie. This is a hugely important question at this time of year. When Earth Day, springtime, and the lure of gardening often lead well-intentioned folks to try and start composting with only kitchen waste. But, as I've frequently pointed out, one, kitchen garbage contributes very little plant food to finished compost, and two, a composter filled with kitchen waste will, at the end of the season, be, well, a composter full of kitchen waste. That the summer heat will not have improved. And a quick look through our archives reveals that when I have tackled this issue directly, I've mostly urged people to recycle their kitchen waste via a worm bin, where the wonderful little wormies will take that garbage and turn it into super wonderful worm castings, which I consider the only thing better than compost for feeding plants and soil. Now, for people in the city, or even in the country with lots of roaming critters around, a worm bin is still often the best answer for garbage. Even I, the compost king, restrict our garden waste to sealed composting units, like tumblers, spinners, and those big black recycled plastic units that have locking lids. The only, quote, kitchen waste that goes into my open piles is coffee grounds, which attract no vermin and do add incredibly valuable nutrients to the finished compost. But even if you do have a worm bin for your garbage, that still leaves a lot of green matter that should be composted. Spent garden plants, the occasional dead houseplant, and pulled weeds, which are perfectly safe to compost if they haven't yet set seed. So the long-term answer is to collect and shred more leaves this fall. Once shredded, you can store 12 to 20 times as many leaves in one bag as when they were whole. There is also the time-honored tradition of trash picking. Impossible to resist when people gasp, throw away their precious fall leaves at the curb. And the big bags with yard waste printed on them, which I call SPBs for stupid people bags, make the picking really easy. Between your leaves and the unwanted orphans of others, gardeners in the realm of deciduous forest should be able to collect, shred, and hoard enough leaves to fuel compost making throughout a full year. Okay, enough preaching. I will now gasp again, directly answer the question. When I was researching my now best-selling book of compost, I pondered this exact query to Dr. Frank Gowen, retired head of horticulture at the University of Maryland and a renowned composting expert. His answer? Anything that was once green and is now brown. Dr. Gowen explained to me that the browned-out tops of the previous year's perennials, like black-eyed Susan, echinacea, ornamental grasses, and the like, are perfect substitutes for fall leaves in a compost pile. All their nitrogen has retreated to the roots, he explains, turning what was once a source of nitrogen into carbon, which is the famous dry brown component of compost piles we're talking about. The bigger and browner, the better. Think old corn stalks, the browned out leaves and stems of last year's hostas, ornamental grasses, and the like. And yes, the browned out upper parts of those plants should still be there for you to utilize in the spring, especially the further north you garden. The top growth of perennials should always be left standing over winter and only removed the following spring. Leaving those tops in place increases frost protection for the roots and crown. It avoids the risk of the late season growth that fall pruning can stimulate, provides food and shelter for boids in the off season, and gives our landscapes what Martha used to call winter interest. At least she called it that before she had to go up the river and make little doilies out of big doilies. The more dried out and crunchy, the more usable such materials are as a dry brown component of your pile. Just remember to shred them well first. Everything that goes into your compost pile should be in the smallest pieces possible. This can be a challenge with corn stalks and ornamental grasses, which is why I yell at people to hoard leaves so often. Fall leaves are the low-hanging fruit of the composting world. Yes, straw also works well, but you generally have to pay for straw. And be careful you get straw and not hay. Don't believe signage or sellers. If there are visible seed heads in the bale, it ain't straw. It is animal feed that will make your compost pile a weedy mess. And for reasons explained in depth in previous questions of the week, don't use paper, sawdust, or wood in place of leaves. A final note. When you pull up weeds or garden plants for composting, keep as much dirt around their roots as possible. Having lots of lively garden soil in the mix can really help move the composting process along with this type of green matter, and it will allow you to get by with slightly less brown material than when kitchen waste is involved. Well, that sure was some good information about treading water till the next leaf fall now, wasn't it? Luckily, yous can read the print version of this and every question of the week at the Gardens Alive website. Just click the question of the week link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to toss me in the pile. Well, at least it's with lots of soil still attached to my roots, she said. Hey, wait a minute. If I don't get out of this studio, we must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. She wants to give me a dirt nap. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check Foist to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Look up the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our alphabetized archive of garden answers. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Our woebegone webmasters are Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. Our green intern is Jessica Mandick. The perfectly composted Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor, Al Banks, well, he just gives me his coffee grounds and says,
here, make some compost out of this.
I'm dry brown Mike McGrath, but one more April shower and I'll green up enough to see you again next week. What's the difference between straw and hay? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll describe the difference between a pretty good mulch and seed for unintentional grain growers, plus your fabulous phone calls.